Welcome back to Schneps Connects. I want everyone out there to please subscribe to the Schneps Connects podcast wherever you listen to us on all the streaming networks or podcast.schnepsmedia.com. I'm thrilled to have with me today Mark Sherian, who's the founder and principal of Mark David Sherian PC, which is a Manhattan-based litigation firm built on a simple but powerful mission: making things right for people who've been wronged. Mark launched his firm in 2016 and has taken on personal injury, employment discrimination and harassment, civil rights, and complex commercial litigation cases. Throughout his career, he has secured multiple seven-figure settlements and held everyone from Fortune 500 companies to government entities accountable, including a $1.5 million recovery under the Child Victims Act. Mark earned his law degree from New York Law School while working in the legal field. His work has been featured in various media outlets, and he's been at the center of several high-profile sexual harassment and Title IX cases. As a respected member of various legal associations and a recognized leader in the community, Mark continues to fight for justice on behalf of New Yorkers every day. So, Mark, thanks for joining. I appreciate you being on the podcast.
I'm very happy to be here.
So talk to me about how you got started in your career. I mean, I'd love to hear what drew you into litigation and eventually having your own firm.
Well, it goes back to when I was in high school, actually. So I've been in New York my whole life. I've never left New York. I grew up on Long Island. I went to Great Neck North High School. And while I was in high school during health class, we watched that early 90s movie with Denzel Washington and Tom Hanks called Philadelphia. I'm sure you've watched that. Sure. And I was intrigued, to say the least, just the dynamic between these two characters and the justice system and the way they both advocated for themselves and for each other. And I was just so intrigued when I watched this movie. And I always had a mild interest in law school, but after watching this movie, I knew that it was something that I needed to do. So wow. I went to NYU for my undergrad degree. I was actually on the wrestling team at NYU.
Oh, wow.
And I just pursued law, and I never looked back. I've loved being a litigator and serving New Yorkers for the past over 10 years.
Tell me a little bit about what sets your firm apart.
You know, I worked at other firms for a couple of years. I started this firm at 29 years old in 2016, and I just felt that I could do things differently in that a much more hands-on approach than other firms. Like, clients of mine are not just numbers. They're given the personal touch that these cases require. Because think about it, the types of cases that we handle, whether it's a catastrophic injury or someone who's been discriminated against or sexually abused, they need that personal touch. They don't need a firm where it's impossible to get in touch with the managing attorney on their case. So I try very hard to provide my clients with a personal approach with every single case. We make ourselves, the attorneys at my firm, we make ourselves very approachable and easy to communicate with. So I think is a lot different than most of the firms out there.
You know, you touched on a couple areas of your practice, but give an overview of all the different areas of law that you focus on.
So we're a bit of a hybrid. I would say primarily 70% of our cases are personal injury. So anything from car accident cases to slip and falls, trip and falls. We also do some medical malpractice cases, nursing home abuse cases, any sort of personal injury case we handle. We also have handled many employment discrimination cases under Title VII, which is the federal law that covers employment discrimination. And then within New York and New York City, you have the New York State Human Rights Law and the New York City Human Rights Law. So we've done a lot of different employment discrimination cases, whether it's someone who's been discriminated against because of their age or because of their gender, or because of a disability or because of a sexual orientation or because of their religion. I don't think people understand how broad the law is in New York City. That I would say in layman's terms just makes it a bit easier to hold employers accountable should they engage in this sort of discriminatory behavior. So that's the type of work that we do. It's a hybrid between personal injury primarily and employment discrimination, which keeps things very interesting.
Well, let's talk about personal injury to start, because you were saying how that's a majority of your practice. What should someone know if they've been injured in a car accident or a slip and fall or even a construction accident?
I would say there are two primary things that are so important these days. Okay. If God forbid you are in some sort of accident or some sort of incident that requires medical attention, everybody for the most part walks around with a phone.
Sure.
The best thing that you can do if you are involved in any sort of incident is to immediately, if you're able to take photographs, 100% photographs, video, some sort of evidence. That's number one. Number two, a lot of cases where it was not reported. So if there's no police report, again, that doesn't mean it's not a case, but you really do want to bring it to someone's attention, whether it's law enforcement or if it happens within a premises somewhere. You want to report that. You want some sort of proof with respect to the date, the time, the circumstances of how the accident occurred. You want that documented because memories fade. It's very easy for defendants to say, well, we have no record of this ever happening. If it was that bad, you should have said something.
That
So those
makes
are the
sense.
two big things. And I don't think I could say you should do one and not worry so much about the other. You really want to do both. Take photographs and make sure, if you're able to, report the incident immediately, whether it's to law enforcement or to the premises owner, or if it's at a store or restaurant, you report it to somebody that works. Those are the two biggest things.
And then explain statutes of limitation.
Very, very important. It's in New York. I think that's the biggest thing. Being a litigator in New York City is knowing the statute of limitations for each and every type of case. So I think for the most part, people need to understand, and I've seen cases, I've gotten cases that have just been dead on arrival because they've waited too long to find an attorney. I'll give you an
Wow.
example. If you have a case against the city, whether it's the MTA or a case against the NYPD, or if you tripped and fell at a city park, in order to sue the city for injuries, you have to file a notice of claim with the comptroller's office within 90 days of the incident.
Really, I didn't realize that.
If you don't file a notice of claim, whether it's the comptroller's office, some instances it has to be with the actual entity. If it's a non-mayoral agency, you have, like, NYCHA, for example, it needs to be filed with the NYCHA office. It's not filed with the city. Or if it's a medical malpractice case and you were at a New York City Health and Hospital, that is a notice of claim that needs to be required, that needs to be filed with the New York City Health and Hospital system. So MTA, separate notice of claim with the New York City Transit Authority. So that's the biggest thing. If you want to talk about statute of limitations, when you're dealing with the city, you have to file a notice of claim. And look, the law isn't that draconian, but I have seen it go pretty bad in that you do have a year and 90 days if you miss that deadline to bring an application for a late notice of claim, but that's not always granted. You have to prove a bunch of different things that I could hit a little bit here, but you have to show a reasonable excuse. You have to demonstrate that the defendants are not prejudiced by this late application, that they somehow were aware of the occurrence, going back to the importance of filing an actual incident report. I can get into what needs to be in the notice of claim, but generally speaking, they want to know the date, the time, the location, what happened, what your injuries are, what are you demanding from them. And then once that's filed, typically the city will then schedule a 50H hearing, which means that you come in and they ask you questions about your accident, and then you have to file a lawsuit within a year and 90 days. That's when you're dealing with the city. When you're dealing with the Department of Education, that's a 1 year statute of limitations. And again, same bit, you have to file a notice of claim. Now, with other instances, if you're just in a car accident with a non municipal vehicle, statute of limitations for negligence is 3 years. So you'd have 3 years to sue. If you're suing someone for an intentional tort, like assault, battery, defamation, those are 1 year statute of limitations. So an intentional act is 1 year. But a breach of contract, for the most part, is 6 years. So my advice, try to hire an attorney immediately. Don't sit on a case because these are very strict deadlines and you don't want to forego your opportunity to bring a case because you fail to bring a notice.
Yeah, it sounds like it could be very confusing for the, average person.
People don't understand it. And then there are nuances to it. Like I mentioned to you, we bring claims under the New York City and state human rights law. From what I understand, you don't need a notice of claim for those types of claims if you're dealing with the city, but you do if it's with the DOE. You can tell I've been through these battles many times,
Right. It
but
takes
again, it's
experience for sure.
very, very nuanced stuff. And it's sad when I get a case and I'm like, well, the notice of claim deadline was last month and that's passed. And I've been burned before where I've gotten involved in a case to try to make an application for a late notice of claim for a plaintiff who, missed it on their own. They didn't hire anybody. And the courts are not so into granting these motions for the most part. It depends. It all depends. It's annoying at the end of the day to make that application.
Share expectations. Someone hires you as a personal injury lawyer for the first time. Like, what should they expect when they hire you?
What they would expect immediately is an investigation. Immediately from when we're retained on the case, we're going to do a 360 investigation on the case. We are going to figure out exactly what happened. We're going to figure out who the witnesses are. We're going to do asset searches on the defendants, property searches on who's responsible, who the players are in that case. Immediately, we send what I like to call letters of representation, letting the prospective defendants know that we've been retained and that this is going to be a case. And in that letter, there should be a duty to preserve evidence. So surveillance video, witness statements, incident reports. So the expectation when we're hired on a case, we're going to get started immediately. As you know, surveillance video can get completely deleted after a certain amount of time, 30 days, 2 weeks, a week. Oh, no. So it's important for us to get these notices out immediately and to conduct our own investigation. When someone's in an accident, it's important that they have 6 months minimum of treatment before we begin any sort of lawsuit. You don't want to start a lawsuit prematurely. Sometimes you can get a case resolved without ever filing a lawsuit. But we take our cases subject to investigation, and that works both ways. We want to make sure that this is a case that's viable, but also we want to make sure that we are building the right case and we're getting all the evidence that we need to maximize our client's resolution. That's our job at the end of the day. Most personal injury lawyers work on contingency, and it's typically a third of whatever's recovered. And it's very important for us to maximize the value of these cases. And we want to make sure we're getting as much money as possible for our clients. So what someone could expect when hiring us is that we're going to do everything that we can to add value to the case. And we're not going to cut corners with respect to gathering evidence and making sure that we are building up the case the right way.
You talked about people not getting to an attorney quickly enough. I mean, that can obviously end a case right there. What can you share are some other like common mistakes you see injured people make, or what could you say people should not do?
Number one, and I've seen this a lot, this actually does happen. Let's say, for example, you're in a car accident and the other car that hit you, let's just say the other car's insurance company reaches out to you as the plaintiff and wants to offer you a quick settlement. My biggest thing is when I see clients try to handle this on their own, it causes a lot of problems when you then go and hire an attorney. I tell my clients what I do, it's like building a house. I need to have a solid foundation. And if the foundation isn't solid, if, for example, you said something unwise to the insurance adjuster, then they're going to hold that against me. I'll tell you something else that I see a lot, and I think it's very important to say out loud. AI, ChatGPT, whatever you use, is not a replacement for a lawyer. I'll say that
Right,
again.
I hope not, right?
AI, well, that's the problem now.
Yeah,
People
I agree.
think Hey, this is incredible. I could run my own case. I don't need a lawyer. It's interesting. I was helping a couple that I'm friends with a housing issue that they were having. And I wasn't charging them or anything. I was helping them. And then I told them I can't get involved anymore with this. You guys either have to retain me or get a housing lawyer. I know for a fact they were using AI to try to negotiate whatever the issue was. And then they come back to me and they're like, yeah, since you stopped being involved with this case, their lawyer doesn't even respond to us anymore. AI is making all of our lives, I guess, a lot simpler. But I think that's the most relevant advice I can give. Don't think that you can speak to the insurance company because they're going to try to lowball you. Don't think that you can handle this case because if you get to a point where you realize you can't handle it anymore, you're making it a lot more difficult for the lawyer that you're going to be hiring that's going to come in on the case, and it's just going to cause problems. So don't try to be a hero. AI is great. I think AI is great, but it's not a substitute for going to the doctor. It's not a substitute for any other professional. It does make our lives easier, but at the end of the day, you need experienced counsel to basically advocate for you in court if it's that big of a case.
Yeah, there's certain things not to cut back on. I would definitely say an attorney is not one.
But people are doing it. People
I
are
can
doing it.
imagine.
I'm
I can
seeing
imagine.
people are doing it.
I bet you get a common question asked of you when you meet people for the first time, which has got to be, what is my case
I get
worth?
that all the time.
And how do you even go about answering that? Or how do you even go about understanding like the value of a case?
Great question. I get that question a lot, especially when I sign up a case and, I'm speaking to the client and they always ask, for the most part, how much do you think a case like this is worth? And what I've learned through the great lawyers that I've worked with and I've been mentored by, you never give a client a number of value on their case. And this is why, and it's very real. I tell them, I can't answer that question because I don't know what your damages are. And that's the case. And think about it, in any case, whether it's a personal injury case or an employment case, right? Personal injury case, if the accident just happened, how did I know how much the case is worth until I see how you've healed? You might not heal that well. You might heal actually pretty well. I don't know if you're going to need surgery or not. I'm not a doctor. Okay. And with an employment case, if you were fired and you're out of work for a month, those are different damages than if you're out of work for a year, if you're talking wages, right? So that way I respond is I'm not going to give you a number because if I do give you a number, it's either going to be way less or way more than what the case is really worth. And when I say that, they understand, like, wow, this lawyer really understands what's going on here. And they kind of back off. And I'm like, it's a little premature to put a value on this case right now. And we'll reevaluate it once we have all of the evidence. Because you got to understand, in every case, I don't care what case you're talking about, breach of contract, any sort of litigation, before you could get to damages, you have to prove liability. Okay. Even in a breach of contract, before you could say, oh, I'm damaged. I lost out on this. I lost out on that. Fine. You may have been damaged. You have $1 million in damages. You first need to prove that there was a breach of that contract. If you can't prove the liability, if you can't prove the negligence, if there was a breach of a duty, okay, you're never getting to damages. So, and in what we do sometimes, if liability is not clear or if it's 50-50, right? You kind of have to take a haircut sometimes. And yes, if liability is 100%, you want to go for full value. But if it's not so clear and it could go either way, you have to assess that accordingly. And you don't really know that until you're in the litigation, like taking depositions and stuff like that. So that's my answer. And I think if a lawyer does tell you initially how much your case is worth, I think you should just run the other way.
Wow. Okay. Good advice. Yeah. No, listen, sometimes people tell people things they want to hear, and that's the only reason.
I'm not that. I am not that. So, yeah, that's the situation.
Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about employment discrimination. A lot of people are impacted by that, but not everybody wants to report it. And there's got to be a stigma there that's associated with it. So, how do you go about addressing that? Or what advice could you give for people that may be suffering from that?
Employment discrimination cases. I love these cases because it really brings about the human element. If you walk into any restaurant or store or anywhere in public, everyone either has a job where they work somewhere or they have people working for them. I don't care who you are,
Sure.
the richest person, the poorest person. And for most of us New Yorkers, our biggest asset is our job. You know, I look at these things, employment discrimination, these are, at the end of the day, these are economic crimes that occur. Okay. I'm a business owner myself, I'm an employer myself. I understand business decisions need to be made. The problem is when decisions are being made because of somebody's protected class, okay? When you're being treated differently because of your gender or your race or your religion and your age. And I think age is something that I'm seeing a lot. You have a lot of baby boomers right now who can't retire, who can't afford to retire, and they're being driven out by and being replaced by two or three younger workers in their 20s and 30s, okay? So again, with the employment stuff, with the employment cases, it's very important to document as much as you can your concerns. That's number one. Number two, unfortunately, I hate to say this, but HR at the end of the day is not your friend, you know? So I think speaking to a lawyer ASAP, which could guide you. I've get those calls many times, like, hey, I feel like I'm about to get fired. I feel like, you know, I went out on pregnancy leave and I came back and now my roles have changed and they're giving me pushback now because I'm a caregiver. I get these calls all the time. And the biggest problem I see when I'm litigating these cases are, well, if it was that bad, you never complained about it. When did you complain about it? Okay. So I think speaking up, documenting these things that occur is really, really important because you should give your employer an opportunity to respond to your concern. But people need to also understand, don't be afraid to speak up. Why do I say that? Because the law does protect you. And I'm going back to the city law, the state law, for at least for the New Yorkers listening out there. Even under the federal law, you are protected from speaking out against any sort of discrimination or harassment that you see, even if it's not with respect to you. If you see a coworker who's being discriminated against or is being harassed, and you speak up on behalf of your coworker, and somehow you're getting retaliated against, there are laws that protect you against retaliation. So I think at the end of the day, short answer, don't be afraid to speak up. Don't be afraid to document and voice your concerns, because the issues that I see in these cases are, it's like, well, hey, we had no idea that you were going through this. Now, I can get more into these employment stuff. I will say, and I don't think people really understand this, let's talk about sex harassment for a second in the workplace. If you are sexually harassed by someone who's a supervisor or who has the power to fire you, hire you, demote you, and you're being harassed by them. In New York, we have something called strict liability because it's as if the company was the one harassing you. And who would you go and complain to? And it kind of, I guess it appreciates the power struggle that one would have with a superior or a boss that has that type of power over them. So in New York, we have strict liability. Now, if it is harassment or a hostile environment with a coworker, the law is that in order to get your employer on the hook for that, you have to be able to demonstrate that they knew or should have known of that employee's propensity for that discriminatory behavior. And if you can't show that they knew or should have known, in other words, if you never complained about that coworker, or if no one ever complained about that coworker, then you're going to have a very tough time proving the case against your employer for the actions of a coworker. It's a little easier when you're dealing with a boss, a manager, supervisor, if you can prove that that actually occurred. But speak up, because there are laws that protect you. And people, like I said, it's their biggest asset. They need to put food on their table. They're providing for themselves, for their families. And the last thing they want to do is speak up about these things. But I will say and reiterate that the law protects people from speaking up. So that's the biggest.
It sounds like to me, when in doubt, call your attorney.
Absolutely. But people need to speak up.
So let's talk about medical malpractice because I think it would be interesting for you to help people distinguish between what is a bad medical outcome versus what's actual malpractice. So how could you distinguish those?
I'll tell you something. So, unfortunately, since COVID, if you disagree with me, let me know. I do believe that the quality of the care at a lot of these facilities have kind of diminished in a way. And I'm seeing a lot of cases that could have been prevented. And when we get a medical malpractice case, ultimately, I don't know if you know this, but for lawyers to be able to sue for medical malpractice, we have to certify that we consulted with an expert, with
No, I
or
didn't know that.
professional. It's called an attorney's certificate of merit. Every medical malpractice case filed in the state of New York needs to have an attorney's certificate of merit. I think that recently there was a case in federal court that said, or I think it was in the Supreme Court that said, if you file in federal court, you don't need that. But for the purposes, if a New Yorker has a medical malpractice case, for the most part, probably going to be brought in New York State Court. So I'm not a doctor. I'm not an expert. And unfortunately, with medical malpractice cases, the medical records do not tell the whole story because a lot of these medical professionals know how to protect themselves. So with respect to a medical malpractice case that we get in, we go through the records with a fine-tooth comb. We do a tremendous amount of research and we have access to different specialty experts that can guide us and let us know if it's a case or not. And I've
Got
been on both sides of that. I had an
it.
ectopic pregnancy case and I hired a professor who teaches ectopic pregnancy at NYU Medical School. And he was my expert on that case. We got a great result in that case. And in that case, my client, who unfortunately suffered an ectopic pregnancy, with that settlement money, was able to afford IVF treatment and finally was able to have a baby girl
That's
on
awesome.
her own with the money that we were able to get her on that case. And I, quite frankly, she thanks me. But looking back on that case, I really thank the expert that we were able to hire to guide us through that. So a lot of times when we're talking about medical, yes, medical malpractice can be hard to understand. And how do you distinguish between a bad medical outcome and actual malpractice? You should go to an attorney, and an attorney, based on his or her experience, will either be able to give you an opinion, or a prudent attorney would go ahead and hire an expert in their Rolodex to be able to give you an opinion on whether something this is worth pursuing or not. But I think the biggest thing is go speak to an attorney. Don't automatically think that this is par for the course and it's fine because you never know. But they are very tough cases, medical malpractice, because I just think that it's very hard to hold doctors accountable for their malfeasance and negligence. And I think it needs to hit a certain level of egregiousness for a jury to really understand that. That's been my experience, but they can be cases. You really need an expert to get in early on, earlier the better, to distinguish whether it's a bad medical outcome or actual malpractice. And sometimes we can just let them know, hey, this is a known risk. With respect to this procedure, it's a known risk. But usually we have experts who guide us through these things.
So another tough area is, child victims. Can you share the impact of the Child Victims Act and, how it opened the door for a lot of survivors?
Yeah, so the Child Victim Act opened up in 2019. And it was actually supposed to be a 1 year look back window, but because of COVID, it was extended to 2 years. So it was from 2019, August 2019 to August 2021. And it was basically a look back window. You could go back in time because there were so many children that unfortunately were abused and never spoke up about anything. And the legislator gave them an opportunity, a 1 year, in this sense, it was 2 years, a look back window to go back in time. And it has been tremendous because now people can have their day in court for abuse that occurred years ago, the trauma that they unfortunately dealt with as a result of this. And I applaud the legislator for also enacting the Adult Survivors Act, which I believe started in 2022, and that look back window ended in November 2023. But these are great laws that were enacted that gave survivors the opportunity to hold their abusers and the institutions that enabled these abusers accountable for what had occurred back in time. Look, we handled a case that the abuse occurred in 1958. We were able to get a $1.5 million settlement that case. And was it difficult? It was. Because you know what? A lot of the cases that I get, we were talking about the statute of limitations. How many years ago did it happen when I get a case? It may have happened last week or yesterday when I get a case. Very easy to investigate a case like that. How do you investigate a case that occurred in 1958? It was impossible. Well, it wasn't because we got a good result. So we have a good amount of child victim cases and Adult Survivors Act cases. And I'm just so proud of my clients that had the courage to speak up, and they're still living with this hurt. And it's been quite the journey for them, litigating these cases and kind of rehashing what happened
Yeah, I can only
before me.
imagine.
But I'm just glad that they have, regardless of what the results are in these cases, I'm glad that they have that opportunity to have their day in court.
Yeah, no one should get away with that. So it's a good thing that that was passed by legislation.
Absolutely. Well, recently now, the New York City Council passed an amendment to the Gender Motivated Violence Act, which is huge. So the Gender Motivated Violence Act basically prohibits any, well, it was enacted in the year 2000. It gives survivors the right to bring civil lawsuits against individuals who committed acts of gender motivated violence. And then it was amended in January of 2022 to create, to basically allow survivors to sue the institutions who enabled these people. Before 2022, you could only sue the abuser, not the actual institutional entity who may have enabled it. Because there was cases that said, well, this amendment in 2022 giving the enabler provision is not retroactive. So a bunch of cases were thrown out against institutional entities under this Gender Motivated Violence Act because the courts claimed this wasn't retroactive. So what the city council did, they sponsored, it's called the Introduction to 1297-A bill, which was sponsored by council member Sylvana Brooks Powers. And it creates a civil cause of action for crimes of violence motivated by gender that occurred prior to January 2022. And it states that the lawsuits may be brought not only against the individual perpetrators, but also against the institutions, which now closes that loophole that led to mass dismissals. So the New York City Council passed the bill on November 25th, 2025, with a unanimous 48-0 vote. But then Mayor Adams vetoed the bill on Christmas Eve, 2025, just a week before leaving office, arguing that the city faced financial exposure and questioned the motivations of certain law firms representing plaintiffs. But the city council overrided that veto. And what people need to know now is that the new look back window commences on March 1st, 2026. And I believe it's a year. Some people have said it's 18 months, but to be safe, let's just say it closes on March 1st, 2027. So you're now given a window where people have an opportunity to seek justice. And if you brought a claim within March 1st, 2023 and March 1st, 2025, you can now amend your complaint for a cause of action under this law. So this was really directly aimed at the survivors whose cases were dismissed. And now that they can bring these claims back against these institutional entities and survivors who never filed a claim at all, now have a new window to come forward. Survivors were able to pursue civil actions against institutions that may have contributed to their sexual abuse. And it's not limited to any sort of category of abuse. It could be, any sort of sex abuse and, any sort of abuse by doctors and major medical institutions. So anyone who is a victim of gender-motivated violence, including sexual assault, abuse, or trafficking that occurred before January 9th, 2022, either never filed a civil claim, had a claim dismissed, or filed during the prior window and wants to add institutional defendants, should be paying attention to this law. And
It's a lot to know. That's why you need a good lawyer. There's a lot of
it's a
details, a lot
lot
of
to
things
know.
that
And I
become
will
lost.
say what I do like about this law, we were talking about notices of claims. You don't need a notice of claim for this new amendment to the Gender Motivated Violence Act. But I will keep in mind, this is abuse that just occurred in New York City. So if it happened on
Okay.
Long Island, it does not apply. If it happened in Westchester, it does not apply. It had to have occurred within New York City before January 2022.
Well, if anything, it goes to show you need a good attorney. And what's the best way for people to get in touch with you if they want to get a consultation or learn more about these topics that we've been talking about?
I can be reached at 212-931-6530. That's the office number. The website is www.shirianpc.com. And on Instagram, we are the Millennial Lawyer. That is the handle. And if you'd like to listen to my podcast, we have a pretty cool podcast with really nice guests. Maybe Josh will have you on my podcast next time.
Love it.
I don't
Let's
know.
do it.
But it's the Millennial Lawyer podcast, and that's all over Spotify, iHeartRadio, YouTube, Apple Music. We're about 30 episodes in, and it's been great, especially if you're a young lawyer and you want to get tips on being a lawyer. It's been a fun podcast.
Well, Mark, it's been great talking to you. I appreciate your time, and it was great to learn more about you and your firm. And keep up the good fight.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure being here. And Josh, keep up the great work.
Thanks so much, Mark.